Good morning, folks. Welcome to Warburton Review on, it's Friday now. Thank you so much for being here. We have a great program, as you can tell, and Connie is, she's just moving a chair. Okay, that's fine. I looked at the program that we've got today, and I had great difficulty in how I was going to orchestrate it. I'm Ed McElhinney. Yeah, I'm a retired fighter pilot, and I got helicopters behind me, so it's going to be difficult for me, but please bear with me today. But we are in the midst here of a hero, and I don't know how many of you know General Brady's story, I guess is the best way to put it, but I feel obligated to let everybody know exactly what went on so many years ago. I, as a retired general officer also, I presented many medals and awards myself, and typically they started with attention to order. So bear with me for a minute, and I will say attention to order. For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity in action at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty, Major Brady distinguished himself while serving in the Republic of Vietnam, commanding a UH-1H ambulance helicopter. He volunteered to rescue wounded men from a site in enemy-held territory, which was supported to be heavily defended and to be blanketed by fog. To reach the site, he descended through heavy fog and smoke and hovered slowly along the valley trail, turning his ship sideward to blow the fog away with a backwash from his rotor blades. Despite the unchallenged close-range enemy fire, he found the dangerously small site where he successfully landed and evacuated two badly wounded South Vietnamese soldiers. He was then called to another area completely covered by dense fog where American casualties lay only 50 meters from the enemy. Two aircraft had been previously shot down and others had made unsuccessful attempts to reach this site earlier in the day. With unmatched skill and extraordinary courage, Major Brady made four flights to this embattled landing zone and successfully rescued all the wounded. On his third mission of the day, Major Brady once again landed at a site surrounded by the enemy. The friendly ground force, pinned down by enemy fire, had been unable to reach and secure the landing zone. Although his aircraft had been badly damaged and his controls partially shot away during his initial entry into this area, he returned minutes later and returned the remaining injured. Shortly thereafter, obtaining a replacement aircraft, Major Brady was requested to land in an enemy minefield where a platoon of American soldiers was trapped. A mine detonated near his helicopter, wounding two crew members and damaging his ship. In spite of this, he managed to fly six severely injured patients to medical aid. Throughout that day, Major Brady utilized three helicopters to evacuate a total of 51 seriously wounded men, many of whom would have perished without prompt medical treatment. Major Brady's bravery was in highest traditions of the military service and reflects great credit upon himself and the United States Army. This is the man who is here. Stay down. Okay. Stay down. Stay down. That's fine. That's fine. I had to do that. I'm sorry. But now you all know that part of the story, and there's much more after that. He made a comment. He said, what was it in the book? You said, earning the Medal of Honor you thought was sometimes easier than wearing it. And that's an interesting comment. We'll talk about that later. But as we go on, you can see we got two beautiful aircraft here. I'm a fighter pilot, okay? UH-1H, and we got the Sikorsky over here. We got the owners both here. We've got Dave Schmitz, who's going to be talking a little bit about the UH-1 later, and Mike Schneider, and he's got the Sikorsky. We'll be talking about that later. The sequence of events, I think we're going to talk to General Brady for a little bit here, and then we're going to talk about each of the other airplanes. We'll do a quick walk around, and then we'll open it up to questions. So that's what I propose, and with that, General Brady, I'm going to open it up to you and just say, I have 1,000 questions. He's got a book, by the way, and there's going to be a signing later in the museum or in the bookstore over there. I've read the book. Interesting stories. And you flew Dust off. Tell us a little bit about the mission.
I know we've got a lot of Vietnam veterans here. From Vietnam, right? Raise your hand, guys. I know there's quite a few here. Any of you ever picked up by Dust Off? Yeah, here we go. Good. Well, much of the story is in in the book about the origins of Dust Off and how successful it was and the techniques we used to get into the battlefield. And so I always usually start with a war story. It kind of tells you what we did. You all know the difference between a war story and a fairy tale. A fairy tale begins with once upon a time, and a war story begins with this is no shit. So we were called out one day to kind of give you an idea to a pickup site in a combat area. The people on the ground were wounded Marines. And as is always the case with the Marines, there's a lot of confusion down there. Got some Marines here. I don't want you to think I'm saying anything disparaging about another service, but for you Marines, disparaging is bad. So if you've ever been in a deal, we got a dry riverbed here, you got kind of a tree line here, you got an open rice paddy and surrounded by trees here, and the enemy is in this tree line, and the patients are here, and the friendlies are here. And so I'm flying with this young warrant officer and made a nice approach into the area. We dropped down into the riverbed, scoot along behind the trees, jumped up over the trees, turned our tail into the fire. You always did that. You did not want the bullets to come through the windshield. Better that they came through the transmission. So you always did that, and you went out the same way that you came in. Well, if you've ever been in a situation like that where they're crawling around, nobody will stand up, and they're shouting and shooting, and it's just a mess, you know what it's like to pucker. And pucker is when the cheeks from the lower part of your body slowly begin to envelop your ears. And so we're sitting there all puckered up, and you also try to shrink yourself. You just try to become just as small as you can. And you're sitting up here, and everybody's crawling around down here. And so we're shrunk up, we're puckered, and I look over at my co-pilot, and his head's going like this, all over the cockpit. I thought that's strange. Strange guy. Back to the patients. Let's get him on. Let's get the heck out of here. And then back to my buddy, and there his head is like that. And I couldn't help myself. I broke down. I laughed out loud. And he didn't miss a stroke. He said, "Laugh, you son of a bitch, but it's harder to hit a moving target." And that's a true story. By the way, that pilot, if you heard the story about the guy who confiscated a Huey and tried to fly it into the White House, he was the Maryland State Patrol helicopter pilot that got between that helicopter and the White House. We looked for him for years. We thought he was killed in an underground drug thing or something. And I heard his voice on a radio in Maryland. He was getting ready to go have lunch with the President of the United States. So that's how we found the guy. Great pilot, even though he was trying to be a moving target. But the key for us in Dust Off was to find ways to get in during the battlefield. And if you used your imagination and if you looked at the terrain and you knew where the friendlies were and you knew where the enemy was and you knew what weapons the guy had, and you'd mix and mingle that in, a highway would actually spring out of the sky and show you how to get in that area. And so we did find different ways to get into different areas. And they talk about blowing away the smoke or the fog or whatever. I mean, where does it go? You can't blow it away. And the way we found this technique was one day In Vietnam, as you guys know, in the afternoon, the clouds built up on the outpost in the mountains. In the morning, you had low valley fog, about 500 feet, just like a snowbank. And we got a call. I had just gone back to Vietnam for my second tour, and I had a bunch of young warrant officer aviators right out of flight school. All their names started with an S. They all thought they were handpicked to fly dust off. Somebody just grabbed these guys and gave them to me. And they never had any experience at all, but they were eager. They were ready to go, and I was worried about the weather, and I was worried about the mountains, and I know they would not stop, and I was worried about how to do these, especially these weather missions. So we got a call one day for a kid who was on one of the outposts, and he'd been bitten by a snake. And those snakes in Vietnam, you know, it's like lay down so you don't hurt yourself falling, because they were pretty deadly. And so initially, we went into the area, and I knew I could fall out because it was VFR under the clouds, but they were in the clouds on the top of the outpost. We start up into the outpost, and of course, you get all screwed up, but I fall out in the valley, broke out, back up again, couldn't figure out how in the hell am I going to get in there. I could not see. So the crew's nervous. The guys are shouting at me, dust off, please, please hurry. He's going into convulsions. So I went back. I said, okay, guys, we got one more time. So we went around and started back up again. And I was totally disoriented. And the gust of wind blew me sidewards. And I always had my window down on the right side. And I was sure we were going in, so I looked out the window hoping to find a hole in the jungle, and guess what? I could see the tip of the rotor blade, and I could see the top of the trees. So I knew I was right side up. And I says, damn. So I turned that sucker sidewards. You have to go very, very slowly. The fog doesn't blow away. It's there, but you can see 20 feet to the end of your rotor blade, and if you've got two reference points, you can do it. We did it, first time. I got the guy to the hospital, and I think he lived. We used that technique from then on to get into low valley fog areas and also patients who are in the top of the mountains. That was one technique. We had a lot of other ones, too.
General Brady, first of all, I need to warn you, you got a former Marine sitting next to you, so be very, very careful, okay? So, yeah, I'm surprised he didn't smack you or something like that, but I guess rank has its privileges, right? So, I will say, you know, this day and age, we navigate with GPS and all that kind of stuff. How about your navigation techniques? You know, you read the citation, and you went to a variety of places, and weather was obviously a problem. You know, I mean, did you go out by radial and DME, or were you so familiar with the terrain and other references out there? How did you navigate?
No, we had maps, and I'll tell you, here's how it worked with dust off, after we finally got the resource refined. We were off the ground in 2 minutes in a Huey, and the average time from the time the guy was shot until we had him in operating room was 33 minutes. So if the odds of you getting shot in a jungle in Vietnam and surviving were greater than if you were in an accident in a highway in America because of that helicopter. But there was no nav aids, no nothing. What you did was the co-pilot ran to the aircraft, cranked it. The aircraft commander went to the operations, and we got a heading and we got a distance to the pickup site. The first thing you do when you lift off is you let the guy in the jungle know we're on the way, because they're worried about his wounded friends, his buddies, and they need to know that help is on the way. So you let them know. Now, as you get into the area, that's when you start analyzing the terrain, the enemy location, the friendly location, what signal. In the early days, we had problems with signals, because it was all Vietnamese, and we couldn't talk to them, but we could say smoke, whatever, and they would say, green smoke is out, dust off. And guess what? You'd look down there and you'd find four or five green smokes. And we went into some wrong areas a little bit before we finally wised up. And so then after that, we would say, you got smoke, Raj. Okay, here's the deal. You pop smoke, I will identify the color. And so that we know it's you, and we're coming. A very simple thing, but it saved us a lot of heartaches compared to the first few times when we went into the wrong smoke thing. But essentially, heading, distance, frequency, call sign, that's all we need. Now, if we had trouble finding him, if it was a LERP guy or something, you needed a hoist, then oftentimes we would use our FM Homer to get in and find him. The worst missions at this time, more of our people were being killed at night and in weather than were being killed by the enemy. We're losing a lot of crews, a lot of aircraft, because they were flying in the mountains, and they were flying at night, get disoriented, and crash. So those were the things. But we found a way to do the weather in the daytime, and later on we found a way to do the weather at night.
Understand. How about, you know, the mission that you earned the Medal of Honor on? You went back and forth several times. What's a typical crew for your dust-off mission? How many guys?
Okay. We had a pilot, co-pilot, medic, and a crew chief.
Okay. And did any of them ever look at you and go, you're nuts, I don't want to go with you, and this is too dangerous? Or are you guys all on the same sheet of music?
Well, we had some cases where they would come back and never fly again. Yeah. And so, did not happen very often. The most important thing, for example, the day of the Medal of Honor, we used the technique to go into the fog to pick up the two Vietnamese wounded. I was not on duty that day, but they called me because it was a weather mission, and we knew how to do that. And then when we were lifting out of there, we heard about, actually they say 51, there were 70 patients in a valley in the same kind of circumstances. And so we said, they've been there all night. Why hasn't somebody got them out? And so we went out to LZ West, but they were not going to let me go in. And so the brigade commander then talked to my co-pilot, and he said, we can do it. Just give us a frequency. Just tell us who we're talking to, and we'll go get them. They were actually in the fog right below the base. And so you got to have a willing co-pilot, and you got to have willing crew members. And when you got that, the crew works together. There's no problems. But if you got somebody that's afraid or somebody that's not willing, or worried, or some way not really dedicated to the mission, that's not good. Mm-hmm. Everybody on the team has to be together, and we all have to be dedicated to getting that wounded guy out. And you go after him like you'd want somebody to come after you, or the way you'd want somebody to come after your wounded relative or friends. You just give it all you got. Mm-hmm.
Who was the initiator of the dust-off mission? Who started all that?
This was all started by Charles Kelly, and he was a World War II veteran. I write about him in my book. We just came back from Vietnam 3 or 4 weeks ago, actually in early May, and we dedicated a memorial to him there near the spot where he was killed. But he was killed trying to rescue some people in a very trying time when they were trying to use portable Red Crosses. It's a complicated story, but he gave his life to save dust off, which eventually saved, in Vietnam alone, 1 million lives. And from then on to today, who knows how many lives have stayed in Afghanistan and Iraq. But the call sign is still dust off, and that was Charles Kelly's dust off. His dying words, when he landed in an area, hot area, and they said, get out, we're under fire. His dying words, when I have your wounded, he took a round right through the heart and killed him on the spot. But those are the inspiration for dust-off pilots, the standard for dust-off pilots and combat medics to this day. So he was probably the most remarkable soldier I ever met.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, how about a typical day as a dust-off pilot? I mean, did you, you work... 12 hours and just, again, on alert, basically?
It's 24 hours.
Okay.
We, as I said, maybe that was earlier, we, in a 9.5 month period with 6 assigned UH-1H models, Only one time we would have three flyable, three that were flyable. In a 9.5 month period, we evacuated over 21,000 patients. Now, those same aircraft, there was more than us. All the dust-off units in Vietnam were doing the same thing. So we averaged something like 28 combat missions a day, four at night, 16 hours flying time every day. We were on 24 hours at a time. First up ship, second up ship, and the third one was a hoist. And so we rigged a horn to a battery thing, and so when the horn went off, if it was the first aircraft, one blast, second aircraft, two blasts, and then we ran to the aircraft, and as I said, we were off the ground in 2 minutes. I think the most challenging, but the weather missions in the daytime, but the most challenging missions were night weather missions. And as I said, that was killing it. And I'll tell you quickly how we found out how to solve that problem. I was out, you got low valley or flat terrain here, and then you go into the mountains. And the mountains went up to about, it's just in the Chulai area. The mountains went up to 5,000 or 6,000 feet, I think, and valleys and things in between them. And so one day I'm sitting out in the valley on a quiet mission, and you know, if you've ever been at night like that, where the tracers and the flares and everything, it's just kind of, it's kind of pretty, really. And so you're sitting there, and I'm looking at the scenery, and then here's a mountain. And the mountain is in the clouds all the way down here. And I look and a flare come down by that mountain. I could see the silhouette of that mountain. And it, I didn't think anything of it at the time, but it just kind of stuck in my head. So fast forward a couple of weeks or so, we get a call from the 101st, and they're out in an area that was they called Death Valley. And they had a whole bunch of wounded, and it's in the middle of a tropical storm. And so I tried to use a technique that we used in the Delta, which at night in the Delta with all the canals and everything, you could get on a canal and with your searchlight, you could follow it like a highway right into the pickup zone. Very easy navigation, no wires, no mountains, no nothing. It was beautiful. No problem at night. Mountains are a different deal. And so I initially tried to follow a river up into the place, but it was raining so hard that it was coming off the window and it was blinding me. And you would have a crew chief in the front and a crew chief in the back, and you'd watch for a light in front of you and you'd watch for a light behind you. In case you got stuck, you could turn around and get out of there. Well, it was like ink. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't get up that river. And then I had this friggin' vision of that mountain in the clouds. But I had a D model Huey and it did not have good instruments on it. And so I knew how I was going to do it. I went back, got another airplane with a transponder and another crew. And then I told them, I want a vector to the pickup site. I'm going to go to about 6,000 feet IFR to the pickup site. Air Force flare ship was at 9,000 feet. And I says, I want you guys to drop flares, and I'm going to see if I can circle those flares down through the mountains and get in, use my FM Homer to get in and pick up those guys. And so the Air Force guy's not sure what's going on, and the son of a gun stopped the flares when I'm about 1,500 feet in 3,000-foot mountains. But the beautiful thing about the Huey was you just stop it and just straight up. You don't dare go any direction because you'll hit a mountain. So I finally got the guy trained. And so he kept the flare in the sky, lighted all the time. And we came down through that stuff, and we got in there, and we got those wounded out. ITO up above the mountains, back to the hospital. We circle over the ocean until we saw the lights of Chulai, and then we go into the hospital. So we made four trips that night doing this, using the same technique, and we got every one of them out. And after that, we were never stopped by night weather, nor were we ever stopped by day weather. We never left a patient in the field, period.
Wow. I will say it's really nice these days to have night vision goggles, and that was way before that. All right, you were talking about the UE. This is the exact model UE that you flew. Is that correct? A UH-1H.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's shift gears for a second. I'll give you a break, and we're going to let Dave talk a little bit about his aircraft. First of all, Dave, thank you so much to bring it here. It is a beautiful aircraft. And all right, tell us a little bit about the acquisition. You know, where did it come from?
Well, it came from Olympia, Washington, where we bought it from Northwest Helicopters in 2015. Just happened, my partner came to me at I flew T-6s for quite a few years, and we were at a safety meeting in Minneapolis, and Gabriel says, Dave, I want to talk to you after the meeting. Okay, and so the meeting was over. What's up, Barry? He said, well, I want to, my son and I want to buy a Huey. I said, all right, well, how much time you got in the helicopters? Well, none, but we're going to flight school. Okay, well, let's just start. And I had just been in the trainer plane, and I saw there were a couple for sale, and so then that's where it started.
Okay, but there's more to that. I told you as a former Marine, but what did you fly for the Marines?
I flew CH-46. I was in Vietnam 69-70 and HMM 364 at Marble Mountain.
Okay, so he was a Marine CH-46 kind of guy there, so yeah. So he's okay. But okay, so you acquired it. Was there a great deal of restoration required?
Actually, no, it was pretty well restored. It was in Vietnam in 66-67 and damaged. And we've got kind of a history on it, and it was returned to the States, which is kind of unusual for a Huey, and went to Corpus Christi and was redone, and then flew around the country in guard units. And it was in Savannah, Georgia, when I actually was Army trained. I was in OCS, got out of OCS in June of 68, and Pensacola was backlogged, and the Marines and the Navy got a few slots in the Army, so I went TAD to the Army for 9 months.
So he's okay, right? He got his Army training.
So they didn't know what to do with us down in Fort Walters or in Savannah. They just left us alone. We just flew, and turned out good. And my fellow Navy trained, they used to call us Army pukes. And so we ended up calling them Navy pukes or whatever. But when I got to Vietnam, I had 208 hours, I believe, in helicopters and 80 hours in a Huey in flight school. And we could fly a helicopter coming out of the Navy in Pensacola. They only had 80 hours in 34s or I think they 206s, something like that. So when I started flying with it, hey, you guys can fly. So we didn't get called Army pukes for too awfully long. And, it was interesting, but I enjoyed my time in the Army, but I went back in the Marines after I got out of flight school.
Outstanding. Okay. And I'll ask General Brady, this is how much time you got in one of these things?
In the Huey?
Yeah.
I haven't got a lot of time. Probably all of it was in Vietnam. Most of my time in the Huey was in Vietnam, and it's about 1,800 hours in Vietnam. But we flew, I can't tell you what a joy it was to have this thing when we got to Vietnam. Before that, they had the H-13. It took both feet, both legs, and a wrist to fly one of those things. And it does with the 34, too, I think, right? You still got that damn thing? In a 19, I swear to God, we flew single ship, single pilot missions in the 19, and it's like this bird, not as big, not as good, but at the end of the day, your left wrist and your left leg were just absolutely worn out, and you had to transfer fuel, and you had to read maps and do all that. But that, I think, made me a better pilot, because when I got in this thing, I mean, you just jerked that sucker off the ground, and it would pick up anything you could put on it. And we were talking the other day about how many is the most patients you ever got on that thing. And my co-pilot said one night we picked up a guy named Webster Anderson, who was later on became a Medal of Honor recipient, but he was on a mountaintop in a tropical storm. We used the flares and everything. And my co-pilot, who kept the record after the after-action report, said we had 21 people on there, 21 American soldiers. Wow. And another pilot recently, I heard, said he had 27 on there. Now, if you've got women and children, then you can get them. But we did not use litters unless it was a head or a neck thing. And you stacked them in there because you knew you were going to have them in an operating room in 15 minutes or so, and that was the key to saving their life. Stop the blood. You know, you protect what they got of one, and you make sure they're getting the other, and that's blood and air. And with those two things, 15 minutes, double amputees, sucking, you name it, and we get them in the operating room, and they're going to live. I forget the numbers exactly, but Vietnam set survival records never before to this day paralleled in combat. I think 10% of our people were wounded in Vietnam, and of that 10% who were wounded, less than 1% died. And so if we got our hands on you, you were going to live, unless you're already dead. And so that was just a basic fact, and the troops really appreciated that. But this was it. It was not so much us. We had a machine that we had faith in, that we knew could do anything we asked it to do, and was great in the jungle. It was quick. It had a nice attitude for approach at night. We flew blacked out. We had no lights on at night, and we did not use lights when we landed. So you had to have a signal on the ground, and it could be one of my pilots landed at one night to a flicking Zippo lighter. And so if you've got a light and you could take this thing, you could stop it above the trees, and then you could tilt it, and then you keep that light between you and the ground, and you don't need a searchlight. They don't want you to use a searchlight because it exposes their position. And it'll get you down there, and then the crew will tell you when you can set it down. And so could not have done it without this bird. It was a lifesaver. And by the way, it's the most combat experienced aircraft in history. The Air Force weenies with all their fighter pilots and all that crap. I mean, and this bird has 7 million combat hours or something, more Medal of Honor recipients, except for one World War II aircraft, I think. I had a friend who ran a museum out in Seattle, the Museum of Flight. He's got all these fixed-wing aircraft, and I said, for God's sakes, why don't you put a real airplane in here? Those people don't fly, they ride. You only really fly a helicopter. Everybody knows that. So the guy had a lot of money, but it took him a long time, and finally we got a Huey helicopter in the Museum of Flight in Seattle, and more people visit that than any of the other aircraft there. And that's understandable because it's better than all the rest of them.
Okay, I think the interview is over. I knew that was coming, General. It was just a question of when, that's all. So I accept the hits, and what can I say? But I will go on, shift gears a little bit, and talk to Mike a little bit about his aircraft that's here. And, oh, by the way, there's bullet holes. We said bullet holes in the floorboards of the Huey over there that have been patched up. Is that right?
We think so. The skin was repaired, but there's certain unidentifiable holes in the floor. Okay. Right.
And that brings me to the Sikorsky over there, because I guess there's a lot of bullet holes in that thing. And Mike, I'll say again, thank you so much for bringing it here. It is a beautiful aircraft. And tell us a little bit about acquisition of that.
First of all, with utmost respect to the general, when I joined the Navy, they told us we were going to take care of the Air Force, the Army, the Marine Corps. So basically, that's what they told us. So we kind of felt like we took care of you guys. So
there you go. But thank you. That's one hit back.
Yeah. Okay. The Sikorsky has 54 documented bullet holes, and it has some damage history in Vietnam. It basically was the second time it was damaged. It was sent to Japan. That's how it basically survived. It was up there when the HMM 362 squadron in 1968, they were told to go home, and they gave all the rest of the helicopters to the South Vietnamese. And this one was up in Japan, was sent to the States, flew in a guard unit a couple of years, and then sent to Davis-Monthan. Mm-hmm.
And you got a crew chief out here that's got some real background with it.
Yes.
Is that right?
Ed Tatman. We had five crew chiefs at one time within the Tulsa, about 100 miles of Tulsa area, that actually flew in the squadron with this helicopter. And Ed is one of the ones that came with us today from Tulsa. He lives in Stigler, Oklahoma. And he flew on in this unit in 1967-68.
The crew chiefs, by the way, the crew chiefs were our parachute. I mean, of all the soldiers of every kind of training imaginable that I ever served with, the helicopter crew chief was the finest trained, most capable, most competent soldier I ever served with. Just that simple.
And I'll pass it over to Ed for a minute. Any comments right now, Ed, about serving and that particular aircraft?
Are we ready here?
Yeah.
Did your engineers, producers want us out here?
Yeah, that's fine. You're okay. You're good.
I appreciate the comments, and I would say, and kind of going back and to honor our general, to me, every time you climbed in that cockpit, you've got to understand what these pilots went through. I cannot, in my wildest imagination, imagine sitting up there holding that stick in a hover. And in some cases, we would have this wheel on a rock, and it might be 2,000 or 3,000 feet off the side right here, and knowing at any time that could end. And to sit there and hold those sticks while we're trying to do our job and everything, just beyond imagination to me. So no disrespect to the one mission. I think you should have got one every time you got behind the stick. I've been flying with this aircraft since 99. We've been going 23 years. We lost our leader in 15, and things slowed down tremendously. Just took the wind out of our sails, and he was the driving force that was behind us and so on. He was a non-military man. He was totally civilian. So he bought this thing for a parts vehicle to support another 34 for lift. So he pushed it to the back of the hangar for 12, 14 years. It was stacked full of pieces. When they picked it up in 1985, this young man, Jesse, step out here just a little bit. This is the son of Mike. He is our second generation pilot. When we're gone, he's going to carry on. I'm not going to tell you his age, but in 1985, he was 10 years old. They went to Tucson, Arizona to pick this aircraft up, and whoever was in charge of the yard there says, "Boys, help me clean this up. Load everything you can in it." And I think you loaded about 18 or 20 of these blades, and they had to walk them back into the tail pylon to get them in there. And then they had to kind of glove them like this, and then stuff foam rubber they could find, and things on top of them to protect them and so on. And of course, they're the most valuable thing. They don't reproduce those, and they do time out. And when they time out, they go in a scrap pile or go on a static display somewhere. Jesse rode down in the old truck, and their air conditioner was what we affectionately referred to when I was a kid as a 265. That's two wing windows turned in and 65 mile an hour and about 105 degree heat. But they got down there and trucked that thing full of parts and brought it home. It went in the hangar for 10, 12, 15 years. The lift business did not materialize. Another business was lucrative enough to keep them going. And it was just kind of forgotten until a guy called and wanted to purchase some parts out of it. And Gerald, our leader, got in that thing and went to digging around, and he found a cardboard box in there with the logbooks and stuff in it for this aircraft. And him being a civilian type individual, he went to leafing through it and found entries that said battle damage at station such and such and battle damage at station such and such. And so he called Mike. Mike, being a military man, he told him this, and Mike says, Gerald, I think you've got a warbird up there. So they got the logbook down and got to doing a little more dissecting and decided they did. Went to putting it back together. The mission changed. Went to putting it back together. What you see here is just almost 100% original. The interior of this aircraft has never been touched except for probably a power wash. I think when it came out of the desert, it had probably an inch of sand in it and dirt and debris. The outside has been rubbed and scrubbed. When we get back out to our location, we've got a picture that's got the bullet holes targeted and kind of give you some idea. And if you look through the cargo door, you can look right at three or four of them right in there. There's one of them for a 6 foot tall man. It is straight in the door, right behind one of the seats. And when we get back out there, I'll try to drop the back of that canvas seat a little bit where you can see that damage. It sticks out pretty clearly there. And of course, when you go to the other side and look at that picture, why, you'll know what it is. This has been a tremendous ride. We take it as a learning tool to schools. We can do things, them guys. Excuse me, General. We can do things these guys with them wings that stick out like that can't do. We can put it in a schoolyard. This aircraft's been in over 200 schoolyards and probably as many veterans events and on and on and on in the 23 years we've been going since 1999. It's a healing tool. We get around behind it every once in a while. Have a little prayer meeting back there. It's an educational tool, it's a healing tool, and it's also a flying memorial to 33 of our squadron mates that paid the ultimate sacrifice right here. And obviously, we feel like that thing demands the first respect for sure. And had a young man walk by yesterday. I'm getting too old to fight, fair. And he was pushing the bassinet and had a couple families with him. And they kind of rolled up, and he said, if you've seen one old airplane, you've seen them all. And I stood and thought about that and visited with Jesse. I'm getting to where I think these things out a little better than I did at one time. And part of me just almost went and invited him to come over and read this, give it a minute, and get away from the aircraft. It's not just another old airplane. And all these airplanes, or most of them out here, the warbirds especially, have got tails to tail. Let's let Jesse, if we can we do that, General?
We were gonna do a walk around and talk a little pilot stuff. We're running out of time, so I'm gonna save that until like after the questions, and we're gonna open it up to questions because I'm sure people have got questions about the aircraft. But I just wanna end the formal portion here with this is the last part of your book, General Brady, and I found it very interesting. And this is something. If yeah, you're in trouble now. I'm gonna try to get even. No, I'm not gonna get even. He makes a poignant comment here, and I'll read it. It says, "Whatever happens to our bodies as we age, our minds are not devoid of romance, and we still dream. In my dreams, I am again a captain, not a general. Hurrying into the mist of the moist morning fog or inky blackness, climbing into the cabin, surrounded by the sweet cell of JP-4, strapping in to the detent, the trigger, the sweet smell of JP-4, the whining engine, the bumpy roar, and off across tracer-marked terrain. Voices in my ear begging for wounded comrades. Hurry, dust off. then the signal, the terrain, the enemy, the highway, down on the collective, forward on the cyclic, kick it out of trim, hard over to the ground, dodging trees, dipping into paddies, snaking forward swiftly, stop, hard left pedal, right cyclic, a fast flat turn, no float, down to the ground. Confusion, we got them, clear on the right, the left. Oops, the sharp crack of gunfire snapping through our bird. Crew okay, no red lights. Up, steady, right pedal rotating into translational, speed, then altitude, then more speed. Full bore ahead into the caring hands of a physician and life. And that was in the tail end of his book, and you can see what this man is really concerned about. And this isn't the general, this is the captain, and he still dreams that. Thank you, General Brady.